This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you respected information from sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your healthcare provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of sources that I'll name as we go along. First up is an article from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled, Medications That May Harm Hearing. Some medications can cause tinnitus or hearing loss. Learn which ones are on the list and how to protect your ears. When medication helps illness start to fade, the last thing anyone expects is for their hearing to go with it. But for many people, the road to recovery takes an unexpected turn when the medication that helps them heal causes hearing loss or tinnitus, known as ringing in the ears, as a side effect. The phenomenon is called ototoxicity, combining auto, meaning ear, and toxicity, meaning poisoning. The term describes inner ear damage resulting from drug side effects that can affect hearing and sometimes balance. Often the changes are irreversible, so it's wise to learn which medications can lead to these effects, says Dr. James Naples, an otolaryngologist or ear, nose, and throat specialist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's very uncommon overall, but there are a growing number of drugs that have ototoxicity as a known side effect, Dr. Naples says. What drugs are on the list? Medications more likely to cause ototoxicity include macrolide antibiotics such as azithromycin, known as Zithromax, and clarithromycin, when prescribed for a long period of time, especially at high doses. Aspirin and other salicylates in high doses. Certain chemotherapy drugs such as cisplatin and carboplatin, known as Kisqali. Loop diuretics such as furosemide, which are often used for conditions such as heart failure and kidney disease, and some biologics, which are derived from living organisms and include immunotherapy, gene therapy, and disease-modifying drugs. Notably, cases of ototoxicity are likely to grow in the years ahead as biologics are increasingly prescribed for an array of conditions, from melanoma to thyroid eye disease, Dr. Naples says. We are learning recently that many of the newer biologic agents have ototoxicity occurring as a side effect, he says. Who's vulnerable to ototoxicity? It depends not only on the type of medication, but in some cases the dose and how long you've been taking it. Using a combination of ototoxic drugs also increases the odds of hearing loss, Dr. Naples says. For example, taking cisplatin and furosemide together might cause much greater hearing loss than taking either drug alone. Regardless, most of the offending drugs are given in high doses and often while someone is hospitalized. Many of these drugs aren't something a lot of people take day to day, he says, although this may change with the use of more biologic agents. When ototoxicity happens, the damage is typically noticed quickly, during the administration of the drug or just after, Dr. Naples says. Usually someone's getting chemo, for instance, and shortly afterward they report this effect. It's not 6 months down the road. Most ototoxic drugs damage hearing by injuring the hair-like projections in the inner ear that convert sound vibrations into electrical signals the brain can interpret. But different drugs have different likelihoods of affecting different parts of the inner ear, Dr. Naples says. Ototoxic drugs can also affect balance, by damaging the vestibular system, the part of the inner ear that senses motion and helps us stay oriented in space. Because the damage might not be reversible, doctors may prescribe a corticosteroid drug like prednisone in addition to stopping the offending drug. Corticosteroid drugs help reduce inflammation in the inner ear and protect the delicate structures there before more are harmed. Managing ototoxicity is a delicate dance. Most doctors choose a medication dosing to maximize a drug's benefits while minimizing potentially ototoxic side effects. And since many of these medicines treat serious conditions, it's not always possible to find an alternative. The caveat to that is that someone may lose so much hearing they can't communicate or navigate their world, but that's very uncommon, Dr. Naples says. Usually we can adjust the dosing of the medication a little to try to avoid any worsening. If you suspect a problem, don't stop taking a medication on your own. Talk to your doctor immediately. Describe your symptoms and ask if your dose can be adjusted or if you can take an alternative drug. But the most important thing, Dr. Naples says, is to get your hearing checked, usually by an audiologist, before, during, and after taking a known ototoxic medication. It's the only way to address the problem, he says. Otherwise, you're playing catch-up, and it becomes difficult to know which effects are from the medication and which are possibly due to prior hearing loss. This next article from Cleveland Clinic Health Essentials is about a problem that's much more widespread than ototoxicity, but it can be annoying to many people and hopefully much less problematic. Why am I sweating in my sleep? 6 reasons. If you sweat in your sleep, you know how annoying it can be. Waking up and needing to change your clothes or the sheets again can take a toll on your sleep and wreak havoc on your morning. Sweating at night is a common concern and can be a real bother. How are you supposed to feel refreshed and ready for your day when you wake up flushed and sweating like you ran a marathon in your sleep? We talked with family medicine physician Colleen Clayton, MD, about the common causes of night sweats and steps you can take to find some relief. If you're waking up drenched in sweat, you've got night sweats. It's not the same as feeling a little clammy after a night of being cuddled up with too many blankets. Night sweats are intense episodes of heavy sweating in your sleep, Dr. Clayton says. If you have night sweats, it's more than a matter of turning on a fan or kicking off the blankets. So here are 6 causes of sweating in your sleep. Sweating is your body's natural response to help you cool down, like when you're exercising or out in the hot sun. But while you're sleeping, unless you're burrowed under the comforter with the heater on full blast, you probably don't need to sweat. And yet you do. Why? Dr. Clayton shares some of the most common reasons. 1 is menopause and perimenopause. Perhaps the best-known causes of night sweats are menopause and perimenopause, the transitional time before your period ends. Here's why. As you enter menopause, your body produces less estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. These hormonal shifts are what cause your periods to become irregular and eventually stop altogether. But they can trigger other changes in your body, including how your body regulates temperature. That can lead to hot flashes during the day and sweating while you sleep. By definition, you enter menopause when you've had a period for a year, when you haven't had a period for a year. But night sweats can linger even after the onset of menopause. So, even if you're in postmenopause, hormonal changes can still cause you to sweat in your sleep. The second major cause, medication. Several commonly used medications are also known to cause night sweats. These include aspirin, opioids, pain relievers, steroids, medication used to manage conditions like cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, depression, and anxiety. If you're concerned that your medication is making you sweat in your sleep or causing other unwanted side effects, talk with your healthcare provider about your options. Don't stop taking the medication without consulting them. The third cause, stress and anxiety. Ever find yourself sweating when you're presenting at a big meeting? When your nervous system is on edge, it can bring on sweat. And your fight-or-flight response doesn't just kick in when you're dealing with a momentary stressor, like driving at night in a blizzard. Stress can become chronic and can affect how your body works. One of the ways your body deals with stress is by increasing your heart rate and narrowing your blood vessels. That heats up your body and can cause more sweat day and night. The fourth major cause, infections. It's no surprise that your body temperature can elevate when you're fighting off a bug like the cold, flu, or COVID-19, but even a low-grade fever can make you sweat in your sleep. Fevers themselves can lead to night sweats, but so can having the chills, which is typical of some viral infections, Dr. Clayton points out. When you have chills, you're probably going to dress warmer and use more blankets. That can add to your odds of sweating at night, even if you don't feel hot. A fifth cause, substance abuse. Using and abusing alcohol and other substances can trigger a sweaty night. Drinking can increase anxiety, cause dehydration, and raise your body temperature, all of which can lead to night sweats. Same goes for misusing prescription medications or using non-prescription drugs. Alcohol and substance withdrawal can cause night sweats. If substances are interfering with your life, seek professional support for overcoming substance use disorder. And lastly, another cause is chronic conditions. Several common chronic conditions are associated with night sweats, including cancer, particularly leukemia and lymphoma, diabetes, endocrine tumors, hyperthyroidism, meaning an overactive thyroid, obesity, sleep disorders like sleep apnea. So pinpointing what's causing your nighttime sweat sessions can help you find ways to get some relief. Start with setting the stage for a cool night. Keep your bedroom between 60 and 67 degrees Fahrenheit and sleep in lightweight PJs. If that doesn't do the trick, try identifying and avoiding triggers. Think caffeine, alcohol, spicy foods, or cigarettes. Practice sweat-reducing activities. Try meditation, breathing exercises, exercising, and journaling. Seek help for menopause symptoms. Prescription medication and hormone therapy can help manage night sweats and other menopause symptoms. Perimenopause can last years and can cause a lot of disruptions, Dr. Clayton acknowledges. Treatments can drastically improve your well-being. And manage chronic conditions. Keep up with your treatment plans, including medications, maintaining a healthy diet, and other measures. Most causes of night sweats aren't serious, Dr. Clayton says, but there are enough causes that I recommend getting evaluated if your symptoms last more than a week. You deserve a good night's rest, both for your own peace of mind and for your overall health. Our next article comes from the Yale School of Public Health, and I put it in the Mythbusters category. New study challenges notion that aging means decline, finds many older adults improve over time. Aging in later life is often portrayed as a steady slide toward physical and cognitive decline. But a new study by scientists at Yale University suggests an alternative narrative, that older individuals can and do improve over time, and their mindset toward aging plays a major part in their success. Analyzing more than a decade of data from a large, nationally representative study of older Americans, lead author Dr. Rebecca Levy, Ph.D., a professor of social and behavioral sciences at the Yale School of Public Health, found that nearly half of adults aged 65 and older showed measurable improvement in cognitive function, physical function, or both over time. The improvements were not limited to a small group of exceptional individuals and notably were linked to a powerful but often overlooked factor, how people think about aging itself. Many people equate aging with an inevitable and continuous loss of physical and cognitive abilities, said Dr. Levy, an international expert on psychosocial determinants of aging health. What we found is that improvement in later life is not rare, it's common, and it should be included in our understanding of the aging process. The findings are published in the journal Geriatrics. For the study, the researchers followed more than 11,000 participants in the Health and Retirement Study, a federally supported longitudinal survey of older Americans. The research team tracked changes in cognition using a global performance assessment and physical function using walking speed, often described by geriatricians as a vital sign because of its strong links to disability, hospitalization, and mortality. That's walking speed. Over a follow-up period of up to 12 years, 45% of participants improved in at least one of the two domains, according to the study. About 32% improved cognitively, 28% improved physically, and many experienced gains that exceeded thresholds considered clinically meaningful. When participants whose cognition scores remained stable over that period, rather than declining, were included, more than half defied the stereotype of inevitable deterioration in cognition. What's striking is that these gains disappear when you look only at the averages, said Dr. Levy, author of the book Breaking the Age Code, How Your Beliefs About Aging Determine How Long and How Well You Live. If you average everyone together, you see decline, Dr. Levy continued. But when you look at individual trajectories, you uncover a very different story. A meaningful percentage of the older participants that we studied got better. The authors also examined potential reasons for why some people improve and some do not. They hypothesized that an important factor could be participants' baseline age beliefs, or specifically, whether they had assimilated more positive or more negative views about aging by the start of the study. In support of this hypothesis, they found that those with more positive age beliefs were significantly more likely to show improvements in both cognition and walking speed, even after accounting for factors such as age, sex, education, chronic disease, depression, and length of follow-up. The findings build on Dr. Levy's stereotype embodiment theory, which posits that age stereotypes absorb from culture through a range of domains, including social media and advertisements, eventually become self-relevant and biologically consequential. Dr. Levy's prior studies have found negative age beliefs predict poorer memory, slower walking speed, higher cardiovascular risk, and biomarkers associated with Alzheimer's disease. The current study shows that those who have assimilated more positive age beliefs often show improvement, Dr. Levy said. Our findings suggest there is often a reserve capacity for improvement in later life, she said. And because age beliefs are modifiable, this opens the door to interventions at both the individual and societal level. The improvements were not limited to people who started out with impairments. Even among participants who had normal cognitive or physical function at baseline, a substantial proportion improved over time. That challenges the assumption that later life gains reflect only people getting better after being sick or rebounding from earlier setbacks, the author said. The authors hope their findings will reverse the popular perception that continuous decline is inevitable and encourage policymakers to increase their support for preventive care, rehabilitation, and other health-promoting programs for older persons that draw on their potential resilience. Our last article today comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and it's entitled Muscle Power versus Muscle Strength. Sort of ties with the last article. How is it that you're going to get better, physically improve as you age? As you age, maintaining physical fitness becomes increasingly important, not just for quality of life, but also for longevity. While muscle strength is a familiar concept, growing research shows that muscle power, the ability to exert force quickly, is a crucial factor in predicting how long you live. Muscle strength and muscle power are two separate but related concepts. They may sound like twins, but they're more like cousins. Muscle strength is typically measured by how much force one can exert in a fairly controlled movement, such as a bodybuilder pressing hundreds of pounds on a leg press. Muscle power, on the other hand, combines strength with speed. It's the ability to move a weight quickly. Ask that same bodybuilder to sprint up a flight of stairs after a grocery run, and that leg press strength suddenly seems different. Likewise, performing a substantial bench press isn't the same as hoisting a heavy bale on a farm in one swift motion. The bodybuilder has a more controlled strength for fitness. The farmer builds more dynamic power for the field. Both are strong, but in different ways. Similar examples apply to daily life. Your ability to slowly sit or stand while you maintain stability in your lower limbs exhibits muscle strength. Rising with speed from that chair without using your hands requires muscle power. In this scenario, your legs generate force with speed to stand rapidly. Both muscle strength and muscle power are critical components of fall prevention. Being able to maintain an upright posture while walking takes strength, while being able to quickly recover balance or footing after slipping or stumbling requires muscle power and agility. A recent study in Mayo Clinic Proceedings compared muscle power and muscle strength as predictors of mortality in middle-aged and older adults. Data was collected from over 3,800 individuals, ages 46 to 75, about two-thirds men and one-third women, who participated in an exercise study between 2001 and 2022. Participants had comprehensive health and fitness evaluations, including tests of muscle power and strength. The study excluded athletes and anyone with conditions that would affect muscle function testing, focusing on a more general population. Study participants were followed for nearly 22 years. Over the follow-up period, 12.4% of participants died, 14.2% of men, and 8.9% of women. When researchers analyzed the data, they found a clear trend. People with lower muscle power had significantly higher death rates over the course of the study compared with those with higher muscle power. This relationship held true for both men and women. The risk of death over the course of the study for those in the lowest category of muscle power was nearly 6 times higher for men and 7 times higher for women. For practical reasons, muscle power and strength were measured only in the upper body in the study. The research didn't include data on muscle mass or cardiorespiratory fitness, which are also significant health markers. More research is needed to determine whether measuring muscle power in other muscle groups or using different types of tests would provide a more accurate prediction. Muscle power may be more relevant to real-world tasks and overall function, especially with increasing age. Additionally, muscle power decreases earlier and worsens more rapidly with age compared with muscle strength. This makes power an earlier indicator of declining physical function. The study suggests that assessing muscle power could be useful in clinical settings. Assessing strength has long been used as a marker of health in older adults, such as through the traditional hand grip test. Muscle power is less commonly measured. This is partly because assessing power requires more specialized equipment and procedures. Assessing muscle power may involve the use of not only the muscles but also the joints, which may be particularly challenging for people with osteoarthritis. One test is the 30-second chair stand. This involves a person moving from a standing to a sitting position, sit-to-stand maneuver, as many times as possible in 30 seconds. The findings of this study support the idea that exercise programs for middle-aged and older adults should include power-based movements, not just slow, controlled weightlifting. For decades, traditional strength and resistance training has focused on sets, repetitions, and the amount of weight lifted, with less attention paid to the speed of movement. Power training, which emphasizes moving weights as quickly as possible, is gaining popularity in both sports and clinical settings. Examples include fast-paced sit-to-stand exercises, stair climbing, and other activities that combine force and speed. According to Mayo Clinic experts in sports medicine, two factors have shown to be most likely to predict success when starting and continuing a new physical activity. The first factor is creating a schedule and adapting the physical activity when you expect changes in your schedule. The second factor is community. If you start a new physical activity within a group setting that offers commitment, accountability, and fun, you're more likely to keep going. To keep and improve muscle power, your best bet is to create a weekly exercise schedule and participate in a group if possible. The article also suggests a couple of exercises you can do without going to the gym to support that muscle power. The first is the sit-to-stand, as they said, and it's pretty simple. You begin by standing on a sitting on a sturdy chair with your feet flat, your knees bent at about 90 degrees, and your back straight. Lean forward slightly from the hips, press through your heels, and quickly rise to a full standing position without using your hands as possible. Then slowly bend your knees and lower yourself back into the chair in a controlled manner. So the idea is to keep repeating that until you can do it faster and faster. Then there's the wall push-up. Stand facing a wall, place your hands on the wall at the level of your shoulders, slightly greater than shoulder width apart. Slowly bend your elbows and lower your chest until your chin reaches the wall, then quickly push off to the upright position. Hope those work for you. That's all we have time for in today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I'd love to hear from you. As always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.